California has a new proposed budget from Governor Gavin Newsom, and it proposes to both spend and save billions of dollars. Housing, education, and healthcare are a few of the areas Cap Radio's Ben Adler will detail for us. California's legislature is very male and very white, according to a new breakdown of state house demographics. We'll speak with Cal Matters reporter Elizabeth Castillo about the diversity problem at the Capitol. And folk singer and storyteller John McCutcheon returns to Insight to highlight his recently released 40th album. It's a tribute to Pete Seeger. I'm Randall White, in for Beth Ryak on this Friday. That's today on Insight. From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Randall White, in for Beth Ryak today. Governor Gavin Newsom introduced his proposed California budget yesterday in Sacramento. I spoke with Cap Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler a couple of hours after that presentation and began the conversation by asking Ben whether the press conference went a bit longer than normal.
The previous governor would go maybe 20, 25 minutes or so and then duck out and let his director of finance take questions. Today, Governor Newsom gave an opening statement that approached an hour and took questions for essentially another hour as well. By the time his finance director was ready to talk, none of us were ready to listen. But Newsom even hinted at this as he stepped onto the stage.
I, unlike the previous administration, may spend a little bit more time on this than you want. So just warning you, full disclosure, this is something I really enjoy. And so I'm going to not take my time, but I want to do justice to the magnitude of the decisions that we are presenting in this budget, because, I know it's rote and cliche to say it's a reflection of our values, but it is a reflection of our values. It is demonstrable that these dollars attach to real people and real people's lives.
And Ben, if we thought this was long, it'll only be longer in subsequent years.
Please don't say that. I don't really want to think about that right now. It is also worth noting that Governor Newsom, instead of holding his news conference for the budget release in the state capitol press conference room, as Brown did in the past, he held it at the Secretary of State's auditorium, and there was a crowd in attendance as well. So differences in style and, as we can now begin talking about, differences of substance.
Well, I guess it took a long time because it's a pretty long wish list, but it's all based on the state having some pretty strong revenue streams.
A $21 billion with a B dollar projected surplus, according to Governor Newsom. That is larger than the roughly $15 billion surplus that the nonpartisan legislative analyst's office projected in November. In coming days, the LAO will weigh in and say whether they agree with this particular $21 billion projection surplus or not. We will see. But yeah, so it really does allow Gavin Newsom to use another cliche, have his cake and eat it too. He is able to set aside significant dollars in savings, $13.6 billion in shoring up the foundation. That's a mix of paying down debt, of putting money into pension systems, basically prepaying some of the to address the retiree health care and pension unfunded liabilities, and putting more money than constitutionally required into the state's rainy day fund. And then he's also able to do a lot of extra new investments.
And he's able to do that new spending and new saving because it's the good times, right? And you asked him about that.
Yeah, I asked him, look, because the economy is doing so well and because Governor Brown and previous legislatures have made certain budget decisions that have helped in combination, in totality, get the state to this point, do you feel lucky?
This is the good times. But the key in a progressive tax system with the volatility that we experience that needs to be addressed, but will not be a short-term endeavor, is to stack away as much money as you can and pay down as much debt as you can. And I hope you see that reflects that in that previous chart on the issue of these four buckets on the $4.8 billion and the $4 billion reflects that as well. So I am extraordinarily blessed. And, this is not naive. You pinch yourself at times like this because the likelihood of ever experiencing this again is very slim.
Now, Ben, while the state is doing well, State Controller Betty Yee announced in the middle of the governor's press conference, no less, that revenues came in nearly $5 billion below projections.
For the month of December, yes. And that is a month where the stock market had more than its fair share of tumbles. California does have a very volatile tax structure, a very progressive tax structure. When the rich do well, the state gets a lot of money. When the stock market does not do as well, the state gets much less money. And so perhaps the stock market being involved partially, and also December is a big month for income tax payments, and so there may be some perceived weakness on that. So it is a warning sign, and Newsom did allude repeatedly to warning signs, which is why he says he is investing so much in some savings.
One potential revenue generator would be to initiate an individual mandate for healthcare, much like what we had under the original version of the Affordable Care Act. What are his projections there?
So he is projecting that creating a state individual mandate for obtaining health insurance, as was previously required under the Affordable Care Act until President Trump and the then Republican Congress repealed it as part of the federal tax overhaul in December of 2017, would bring in about $500 million with an M dollars a year, half a billion a year. And he would take that money and he would put it into covered California subsidies. Again, we're talking about subsidies on the individual marketplace for folks who struggle to afford health insurance. So he would increase subsidies for people earning between 250% and 400% of the federal poverty level, and he would create new subsidies where none currently exist for people earning between 400 and 600% of the federal poverty level. The thinking there being that if you require folks to get insurance and then folks who choose not to get insurance pay the penalty instead, you take that money and you increase the subsidies to make it more affordable for people to get insurance. So it's kind of, I don't know if it's quite a chicken and egg. I don't know if that's the right metaphor. I'm still processing a two-hour press conference, but the two are tied at the hip.
Is the individual mandate something that he could get passed by the legislature?
It's a good question. First of all, there is a debate over whether it would require a two-thirds vote because it has been considered a tax by Chief Justice John Roberts in the U.S. Supreme Court, or if it would be a penalty, as Governor Newsom said he believes, and therefore only require a majority vote. The Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association told me yesterday they believe it's a tax. They believe it would take a two-thirds vote. Then the question is whether it is politically feasible. There are several proposals for new revenue that Newsom is talking about. This is one of them. He's also talking about a 911 fee, a water drinking fee. And these are all separate proposals, discrete proposals that have many supporters in and of themselves and folks who feel they're necessary for various reasons. And I think I'm missing one. He did talk about potentially a payroll tax expansion to pay for his expansion of paid family leave, but he said that was one idea and only one, and he wasn't necessarily saying that's the right idea. But those are all tough votes. Maybe not for people who represent San Francisco, like where Gavin Newsom is from, but for people, Democrats who represent the Central Valley or the Inland Empire or Orange County, which has long been represented by Republicans. And so I think it remains to be seen if those, all of those, any of those proposals are palatable.
Ben, you know, through my reporting, I closely followed State Senator Scott Wiener's Bill 827, which didn't even make it out of its first committee hearing.
Listeners
last
don't
year.
Know this, but it's tattooed across your forehead.
Practically, right? Well, now it has some tweaks, and it's titled SB 50. It pushes to increase housing near transit stops. The governor stated at the budget unveiling, we don't have the sound on this, so I'll just say it here, transportation is housing, and housing is transportation. It sounds like Senator Wiener has a friend in Governor Newsom on this topic.
Well, he was asked specifically about the Wiener bill, and he said, look, it's gone through some changes from last year to this year. I thought the idea was a good one last year, but he didn't necessarily specifically support the exact bill last year. He says he believes it's been changed potentially for the better. He mentioned that Eric Garcetti, the Los Angeles mayor, now supports it when he doesn't in the past or spoke favorably of it this year. So he wants to take a look. He hasn't yet. He doesn't have a clear position on it yet. He is realizing that many governors choose not to comment on pending legislation so they can, you know, negotiate it in private with lawmakers, and we are early in the legislative cycle. But they are, you know, to your point, sounding similar themes about the need to get governments, local governments, to meet their housing goals and to build in intelligent ways. And he's even hinting that he might try to do a carrot and stick approach to state funding, not just for housing, but also transportation, because as you said, transportation is housing, housing is transportation, and potentially gas tax revenues for road repairs that voters protected last year by rejecting Proposition 6, the repeal effort on that, well, some of those might be clawed back, I guess, by the state if Gavin Newsom gets his way, if local governments don't meet their housing goals.
Literally pulling SB1 funds from municipalities that don't build the number of homes that they need to.
That appears to be what he's talking about. It is early and we don't have specific language on it, but it's certainly a topic of conversation, sure to get local government attention.
Right. Leading up to the budget unveiling, we heard a lot of talk about a focus being on education. We spoke with State Superintendent of Public Instruction Thursday on Insight, and Tony Thurman seemed optimistic about what the governor would propose for education. And for the most part, he was probably right to feel that way. From preschool on up through college, there would be increased money in this budget, right?
Yes. Significant investments for the UC and CSU, twice as much in some case for the UC over what Jerry Brown has been proposing, and roughly, not exactly, and approaching three times what Jerry Brown had wanted at times for the CSU from year to year. And that's just ongoing funding, and then separately some deferred maintenance one-time appropriations being proposed as well. Only, however, if tuition remains frozen. And then there are proposals for a second free year of community college. That is relatively inexpensive, just $40 million with an M dollars for the second year. The first year was implemented last year of free tuition at community colleges, and that had a price tag, I believe, of $46 million. So it's a very inexpensive campaign promise for Gavin Newsom to keep. Of course, he's going to go ahead and keep it. And then in addition to big investments in K through 12, which are required under the Proposition 98, you also have big investments in early childhood education. He's going to try to create universal preschool for four-year-olds. He's going to try to do that over a span of a few years. He wants to create full-day kindergarten because some families do not enroll in kindergarten because it's only half day and they need child care the rest of the day, and a variety of other proposals as well.
Governor Newsom wants to drastically change the juvenile justice system. What's his plan to do that?
Wants to move it into the Department of Health and Human Services. In other words, instead of treating it as a corrective process, treat it as a rehabilitative process. So that is going to be a pretty big debate in and of itself, separate from the budget, even if it is included in the budget. And it remains to be seen what kind of support that is going to have.
He addressed the federal government's partial shutdown, saying the state can help immediately with furloughed workers.
He did. He said that he wants furloughed workers, if they do not get their paychecks, to come into the state's Employment Development Department, which offers the, you know, the unemployment aid for people who are laid off. Newsom says they can get their money that way. I asked, well, hey, what happens if the federal government, as it frequently has done after past government shutdowns, back pays workers? Because in that case, you'd be getting paid twice if you're a federal worker,
right?
Once from the state, once from the feds. He said, we're cognizant of that. We're trying to figure out how to make that work. But it almost feels like the state would be advancing money that the worker, the federal worker, would have to pay back to the state. It seems like it could be a complicated process, and I'm not quite sure how it would all play out. But the fact remains, Governor Newsom says, if you are a federal worker, if you are furloughed, you should seek unemployment aid from the state.
Ben, how have the Republican minority responded to this budget?
And they are a super minority, or even a giga minority. They only represent roughly a quarter of the seats in the legislature, not nearly enough to block a two-thirds tax increase if all Democrats vote for it, which is not in any way a given, nor is there currently a broad-based tax increase of any kind proposed, I should say. But Republicans had mixed words. They are concerned about the growth of spending, but some of what's being proposed they like. I had the top Assembly Republican on the Budget Committee tell me, look, we really like the child care investments. That's a bipartisan issue. We think that's on the right track, and many of us were looking forward to that proposal from this new governor. They raised some concerns about Medi-Cal. expanding it to undocumented young adults, not just because of the immigration issue, which is, of course, a big issue for Republicans, but also because current existing Medi-Cal patients have a very hard time getting service in some cases because the reimbursement rates are low and doctors are hard to see. There aren't as many doctors who will see Medi-Cal patients. So their concern is you're expanding it to serve more people. You also need to make sure that there are more doctors who are able to see these people. So that's a concern that Republicans have as well.
And I imagine, as in years past, they're supportive of the Rainy Day Fund.
Yes, certainly they're supportive of that. And they're cognizant of all the warnings that Governor Brown and now Governor Newsom are saying as well, as are Democrats. I mean, it's worth saying that nobody wants to go back and make a whole bunch more cuts that had to be done in the recession. I mean, at times the budget deficit was $42 billion at its trough, I guess you might say, under Governor Schwarzenegger. And so nobody wants to go to that point. And the question is how best to prepare for it while balancing what the political and policy goals are of the Democrats who control this state.
So much more to get to in this massive budget. And of course, we'll report that out in the days and weeks to come. And Ben, this really is just the start of a very long process.
Very long process. It will not wrap up until mid-June or even late June, mid-June being the legislature's constitutional deadline to pass a budget. And the governor would need to sign it within 12 days after June 15th. But technically, it needs to be signed by July 1st. So we're looking at many, many months. But what you have in this situation is a legislature and a governor much more aligned at the start of the budget process, it seems, than Governor Brown and lawmakers were in the past. They always got there in the end, did Brown and lawmakers, but it was a bit more of a journey. This time, many goals of lawmakers, failed goals from previous years that Brown was not willing to fund, are reflected in Newsom's opening proposal. And this is just January. He'll, of course, have the May revise updated budget proposal, which will more accurately reflect revenues for the coming fiscal year. So we'll see what happens in the economy between now and then. Does it continue to keep going up, or are some of these warning signs turning into some pitfalls and potentially the opening indicators of a recession? So a long way to go.
Ben Adler, Cap Radio's Capital Bureau Chief, thank you so much for your reporting on this. And I know it was a long day.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Randall.
And of course, we'll have much more on the budget from Ben on our website at capradio.org/insight. Happy to have you with us on this Friday. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. It's your NPR station. You are listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White in for Beth Reack today. California is famous for its diversity, but the new class of lawmakers in the state legislature, it doesn't necessarily represent the demographics of the constituents. CalMatters reporter Elizabeth Castillo joins us now to explain an interactive tool that lets you sort lawmakers by a number of different things: race, gender, identity, age, some other characteristics. Elizabeth, welcome to Insight.
Awesome. Hi, thanks for having me.
No, you can say awesome.
Yeah, everything's awesome.
Hey, it's Friday.
That's actually
right?
A Lego song.
So, Elizabeth, this is a feature that CalMatters has done for a while. It updates it after each legislative election in California. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. My colleague, Matt Levin, he led the project for the last session. And so we did want to make sure we updated it again as the new lawmakers were sworn in.
Is it popular? Because I know you can, on the CalMatters site, you can sort of track what people are clicking on.
Yeah, I think a little guy by the name of Gavin Newsom has been kind of we've been fighting with him this round, but yeah, it's definitely popular. We really love how user friendly it is. I think you were telling me too how it's so fun to just kind of click along and really be able to see by each factor, watch the numbers drop down, really.
It's very user-friendly. So it's basically a map of California, and there's a dot for each legislator. And then you just start putting in your information. In my case, a white male and not a lot dropped off, you know, when I did that. As soon as I put in LGB for lesbian, gay, or bisexual, it went down to one, Scott Wiener in San Francisco. So you really can see how once you start to get into certain demographics, the numbers fall pretty quickly.
Yeah. I think even for me, you know, I'm in my 20s. So like once I hit the age, like, boom. So there's a handful of Latina women lawmakers. But yeah, once you hit the 20s, Sabrina Cervantes was in her 20s when she was sworn in. But so she's moved. So.
so now there's no representation for your specific demographics. Why focus on the demographics at the legislature?
So I think it's really important to kind of point out that, you know, lawmakers come from your community. They will be representing you in every way. They're representing your voice, right? So if you have someone who doesn't really maybe understand your perspective or your background or your life experiences, that's really going to impact, you know, maybe what bills are going to put forward, like what they're going to say and how they represent their constituents. You know, I spoke to Sheila Kuehl for another story that I'm hoping to do to accompany this project, and she was saying how even at first with women, you know, you have men, you know, trying to make these laws about childcare and all these things that maybe at that time they're unfamiliar with. And you have like no women lawmakers who actually, you know, have their children and know. And so just really making sure that it's representative of different experiences and what a person goes through day to day.
What seems to be the sticking point? Why aren't our representatives as representative of who they are demographically? I know a lot of cities in California have switched to district elections in order to make their city councils more representative of the neighborhoods and that sort of thing. Is it a districting problem? Is it how the lines are drawn?
Well, one big thing we should point out is likely voters. If you think about it, even with Latinos, you know, likely voters represent around 20% of Latinos, and the legislature represents about 20%. But when you go up to actual Californians, those who are over 18 and of voting age, that's a little more to like 35%. But, you know, just because you're 18 doesn't mean you're going to vote.
So it's who's doing the voting.
Exactly. So that's kind of like a big thing when likely voters tend to skew more white and older. So that's why our legislature might skew that way.
So let's get into some of what you and your colleagues found with the current legislature. The web article that you have mentions a Jim Bob caucus in the state legislature. Explain for us what that means.
So, yes, the Jim Bob caucus means that there's this large number of, well, a number of lawmakers that are named Jim, James, Robert, Bob. And if you even want to go in further, there are actually more white lawmakers named Jim or James than there are African-American women or Asian-American woman, really, there's one combined. So, wow. Really thinking about those types of things.
And when you combine the two names together, then you really start to.
Then that caucus starts growing. And then, you know, even just men in general, because some of the Jims and James and Bobs, they're people of color. There's James Ramos, he's Native American, but still, all these men, and really just seeing how that kind of eclipse maybe. You know, some other factors of our lawmakers.
Was it your job to go into each elected official and figure out their demographics? And how do you do that in some cases? Because
I'm so glad you brought that up. That was actually a big thing for James Ramos. He's Native American. I wrote it down. He's California Indian. But he's from the Cahuilla tribe and the Serrano tribe. And we actually just had to call their office and to verify, making sure that we properly represent who they are. So,
because if you just went off a surname and just started to speculate.
Made some assumptions. Like, that's not entirely right. I think, Assemblyman Ramos is very close to his California Indian heritage. He grew up on a reservation. And so I really think making sure that you get these facts right and aren't just right, making your own assumptions or just, you know, coming up with your own answers.
How big is his Native American caucus?
You know, I actually don't know that.
We'd have to go into the tool.
Yeah.
Do it, which I should have on the screen next to me right now, and I don't. Yeah. But that would be interesting. Were there any people that were hesitant to let you know how they identify, you know, their sexuality or their ethnicity or those sorts of things?
I think funny enough, age was kind of a weird thing. Uh-huh. I think some people were more hesitant to be like, well, let me double check that I can, you know, give you their birthday or, you know, but right. But others were like, oh, yeah, that's common knowledge. He had a birthday. You know, I think for one person, he just had a birthday earlier this month. So I think that was, he still stayed in the 30s, but he was like, oh, yeah, well, his birthday's coming up earlier this month. So, you know,
I assumed all that information would be so Googleable in terms of birthdays and stuff, but it's not that easy to find.
Well, for some, it is pretty easy to find. But for others, if like you think about the newly sworn in lawmakers, there's not, you know, they don't just have a ton of information on Google. And really, you know, verifying, I mean, it's pretty easy to get a number wrong. Maybe like they're born November 2nd versus November 1st or January, you know.
Right.
So, yeah.
Did you get a chance to talk to any of the Jims or Bobs about being part of the largest caucus?
You know, I have not. No, I think that would be more for my colleague, Matt. But I do think that, right, that's a very interesting thing that we continue to point out. And also, it hasn't changed from last time. Last time, there were a lot of Jims and James, and this time, there's still a lot of Jims and James and Bobs.
So it's just consistent. And is that because there's not that much turnover, or there's new Jims and Bobs coming in?
I think there were a couple of new Jims and Bobs, but yeah, there's definitely some people who stayed there, like Jim Wood. He's still been around. So, yeah.
I encourage people to go to, when they get into work today, or, you know, if you're at home, is there an app? Is it on the app, or is it just on the website?
It's on our website. It's on our homepage. Uh-huh. And it's, you know, pretty Googleable as well. You can just do like Cal Matters, legislators like you. And it's usually like one of the top things that comes up. And you'll see my colleague's Matt's analysis. And also, quick shout out to John. He was a really big person to make this so interactive and so user-friendly.
That's part of your digital team?
Yeah, yeah.
What's John's last name?
John, it's D'Osborne Agostino, I believe. Uh-huh. Oh, no, Osborne D'Agostino.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you, John.
Yeah,
sorry to put you on the spot.
Yeah, no, I was like, I should write it down.
Right. No, our digital team here at Cap Radio does not get shout outs enough.
And yeah, really... we really wanted to point that out. Both me and Matt were like, John, you're amazing.
Yeah, it's because that's the way things are headed. And so if you could do all the Googling yourself and that sort of thing, but CalMatters has made it very easy to find out if you are represented in the state legislature. And I have to admit, I was a little surprised because I thought that there would be a much larger contingent when I started drilling down on my specific demographics, and they weren't there. So I encourage people to go there and check it out. And if you feel like you are underrepresented, you have some time to get somebody on the ballot, right?
Yeah.
To represent
you.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, wanted to point out as well how there's only one Asian American woman in the legislature. So that's State Senator Ling Ling Chang. So she's a Republican. But, you know, when you think about that one person out of 120 seats, that's kind of stark.
In California, which has such a rich Asian population.
Yeah, definitely.
We're speaking with CalMatters reporter Elizabeth Castillo about the makeup of the California legislature and, well, its lack of diversity. Are California lawmakers a more diverse group than federal politicians coming from California or in as a whole?
Well, I think federally, that's an interesting comparison. I believe her name's Katie Hill. She's actually bisexual. So I think that's kind of interesting that there have been no openly bisexual or transgender lawmakers.
She was just recently elected in Arizona?
No, in California. She's from Southern California.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So she's represented at the federal level. So I think it really just depends, you know.
Uh-huh.
There's like...
Is there a tool for that? Like a similar tool?
We haven't done a federal tool, but that's something that we can definitely like consider moving forward. Yeah,
uh-huh.
Giving us ideas.
Does CalMatters have other organizations in other states? Like, is there a Nevada Matters type of thing?
You know, we're actually like total startup. We're just in California right now. We're a nonprofit. And I think that's like another reason why we're really trying to focus on the state legislature, because the mission of our nonprofit is to focus on state policy and politics. But we've obviously looked to other nonprofits across the country to see like what they're doing and how they're, you know, navigating the nonprofit media world.
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
CalMatters does such an amazing job. I have to say that on a regular basis, when I'm preparing for Insight or, you know, I'm working on a piece for the newsroom or even before my newscasts on All Things Considered, I always like to dig in a little deeper and make sure there's not something I'm missing. And I'll Google something and I don't know the exact statistics, but I would say half the time there's a CalMatters article right there that's right on point to to the information that I need. And so CalMatters, you guys just do amazing work. How many years has CalMatters been operating now?
CalMatters is still pretty new. We're just in like our first few years, really.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's something we're just like always growing. I'm actually, full disclosure, a newer hire.
So. Yeah, how did you get involved?
So I started out as an intern last summer through the Dow Jones News Fund, and they kept me on as an intern through the fall, and they actually hired me last month.
Uh-huh. You're from California.
I am from California. I actually grew up in Bakersfield,
mm-hmm.
and I went to school in Chico, so I'm very California.
Yeah, you've been around the state, and you've seen the diversity that is not necessarily reflected at the State House.
Yeah, especially in Bakersfield. You know, there's a pretty large Latino population. I think we mentioned the federal level. A lot of people know Bakersfield now because of Kevin McCarthy.
Right.
But, you know, there's a huge Latino population. That's something that we were seeing, too. More Latino lawmakers were elected, even from more inland parts of California that tend to skew a little more conservative. And there actually is a Democrat from Bakersfield as well, when Bakersfield is actually a pretty conservative area, too. So really seeing how the demographics are shifting and changing and what people, you know, are looking for.
And more Latinos went to the poll this election cycle, did they not? Went to the polls, plural?
Yes. I think they are going to the polls more, but it's still important to remember, like, likely voters, and even though they're going to the polls, they might be older. They might not still be as reflective of the Latino population.
Elizabeth, as we consider the makeup of the demographics at the state capitol, what sort of impacts can a politician's demographics have on then the policy decisions that they make? Do we have hard examples of that?
Yeah, I think a perfect example of that would be the LGBT caucus. They've made a lot of progress with the LGBT community. They were working on a domestic partnership bill, you know, over a decade before gay marriage was legalized at the national level. And I think, and also even looking to them for representation, if you look at the caucus, it's comprised of so many different people. And so I think pushing for those different communities is really, really important and really valuable, and making sure that you have a voice, because it would be hard for a straight person to understand everything that maybe an LGBT person would have to go through. So it's really important to have those voices and to have that different representation.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned that there's a filter for LGB, but there's no T on that. Explain that.
Yeah. So actually, Colorado and Virginia both have transgender lawmakers in their state house, in their government. But California has not. We have never had a transgender lawmaker. That's still something that, you know, they're trying to push for. The LGBT caucus has been pushing for, like, trans rights. But once again, when I spoke to Sheila Kuehl, who was the first openly gay or lesbian person in the state government in the 90s. And she said, you know, you really can't be, it's really hard to legislate for this group of people that you don't share their experiences. You know, trans women are often, violence happens to trans women all the time, and there might not be enough protections in place for them. So it's really important to see, like, you would need a trans lawmaker to really see, like, what types of protections are needed, what types of laws need to be passed.
California had its first openly gay person elected to a statewide office this year.
Yeah, that's Ricardo Lara. I think the caucus is making a lot of big, they have a lot to celebrate right now. Ricardo Lara broke the glass ceiling for them through that. And also important, Toni Atkins, you know, she was the first openly LGBT person to hold the role of Senate President Pro Tem. So,
Elizabeth, what do you and the people at CalMatters hope people take away when they use this site?
I think really recognizing, you know, I think a lot of the time for California, people are like, oh, California, it's so progressive. But, you know, remembering that, no, California still has its struggles as well. California still, you know, is struggling maybe with diversity, maybe with representing all of the changing voices that the state has. So I really think that people, you know, need to recognize that. And right, hopefully they will go out to the polls and maybe will elect someone that is a lot more like them.
Right. CalMatters reporter Elizabeth Castillo talking about a tool you can use. What's the name of the tool? Legislators Like You.
Yeah.
This tool that you can use to see whether there are people similar or like you making laws at the Capitol in Sacramento. Thanks so much for being on Insight today.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, we appreciate it as well. And we have more on our website at capradio.org/insight. You are listening to Insight on this Friday right here on Cap Radio, your NPR station. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruyak on this Friday. Folk singer and storyteller John McCutcheon is releasing his 40th album. And I need to clarify with him, does it come out today?
It does.
It does. Comes out today. It's a tribute to the late American folk singer Pete Seeger. McCutcheon is on his annual West Coast tour and is no stranger to this show, Insight. He joins us once again, this time to highlight his inspiration behind the album to everyone in all the world. Welcome back to Insight. Great to have you here, and I'm glad that I'm on this side of the mic.
I'm glad I'm on this side of the mic. It's great to be back, and nice to meet you, Randall, and especially in this year, the centenary year of Pete Seeger's birth.
Oh, right.
Uh-huh. And back in 2000, people are always asking me, why this? Well, in 2012, it was Woody Guthrie's 100th birthday, and I put out an album of Woody Guthrie songs. He was the guy who inadvertently, through a songbook in my local library, taught me how to play the guitar. And then in 2015 was the 100th anniversary of the death of the great labor songwriter Joe Hill, as in I Dreamed I Saw Joe Hill Last Night. And so as soon as I was done with that album, I thought, you know, Pete is kind of the third leg in that three-legged stool, and his birthday's coming up. So,
and you and Pete Seeger were friends.
We were, yes. He was a remarkable man because from the moment we met, and I was in my 20s, and he would have been in his late 50s, he treated me like a peer. He was my elder in every imaginable way. He just saw the people who did this kind of work and played this kind of music. And our mutual interest in exploring traditional American music and writing and singing about contemporary issues.
Did you agree politically as well? Pete Seeger, you know, well known for his politics. He was a registered communist early on, but he did publicly clarify later on that he did not agree with the Soviet style of communism, and I'm wondering.
I do not agree with the Soviet style.
I'm wondering how aligned, because you're somewhat political as well, or at least socially active.
I had a mother who was that toxic combination of a Catholic and a social worker, and so it was absolutely necessary that I was going to view the world with a certain vision. And yeah, Pete and I agreed on some stuff. We disagreed on some stuff, but that's the way this kind of wonderful dialogue works. But we more often found ourselves in alignment. We believed in human rights and in people having the power that is innate to them and being able to put a curb on people who misuse this power.
With such a large songbook, how did you choose which songs to cover?
Well, I just picked the songs I really loved.
Uh-huh.
Almost all the songs I learned when I was young. Some as young as 13. And in fact, there's only one song on the entire album that I actually learned as an adult. So I feel like I've been waiting 50 years to make this album, both as a tribute to my friend, my mentor, my inspiration, and also to have some fun introducing Pete's music to a whole new generation of people who, I mean, a lot of people don't even know he wrote Where Have All the Flowers Gone?
Or yeah, I was going to ask
If
you about
I Had
that.
A Hammer, or, you know, Turn, Turn, Turn. There's songs that are so much a part of our vocabulary. And he didn't make a big deal of it.
You did include Turn, and If I Had a Hammer.
And Guantanamera.
Those were
the three sort of iconic songs.
I was wondering why you didn't include Where Have All the Flowers Gone?
Well, people are going to ask me all kinds of questions. There wasn't enough. There's 15 cuts on the album, which is generous in today's world. And it was just, I didn't know how to do it in a way that it hadn't already been done. And what's been really gratifying, the early feedback we're getting on it is, especially from young people who said, man, I thought Pete Seeger was just this old sing-along campfire type guy. And wow, there's a song here that really rocks. And you did really, If I Had a Hammer as a Cajun song. And I have lots and lots of my friends who joined me. Believe me, it was an easy call to make, saying, hey, I'm doing an album honoring Pete Seeger. And I remember the bluegrass band Hot Rise came in and we did a piece together. And I said, I need to get you information. They said, we're getting paid for this?
John McCutcheon, which song are we going to start with? I know you want to start with one of the Seeger songs.
Pete had such wide-ranging interests and effect. And he was one of the very first folk singers to ever record any children's songs.
And you started recording children's songs.
I didn't start with that, but I did once I had kids. It was inevitable. But this is one I learned when I was a kid. And it's just a short little ditty, and it's actually the title song to the album. My hand, I shake their hand. To everyone in all the world, I shake their hand like this. All together, the whole wide world around. I may not know your lingo, but I can say by jingo, no matter where you live, we can shake hands. All together, the whole wide world around. I may not know your lingo, but I can say by jingo, no matter where you live, we can shake hands.
John McCutcheon there with To Everyone in All the World. I wasn't right there at the mic at the time when you finished because I was videoing you with my phone. Which I'll share later on Twitter and that sort of thing. In the introduction, John, I called you a folk singer, but I've read reviews that say your music style has evolved to a heartland rock-inspired ballads. How do you describe your music?
Well, there was a period of time in the 1990s when I realized that I had a bunch of guys in the studio that could really do anything. And so I started writing songs in all different stuff. That's from Wikipedia.
It is.
And actually what I have done as I've gotten older is started to revisit some of the, sort of more acoustic sounds that I got started with. But on this album, we did Waist Deep in the Big Muddy, which was the song that many of your listeners will know got Pete censored off the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour.
Right.
And I always thought that when I heard that song the very first time, I said, oh, I'd like to hear, some big rock band do this. And I played around with it in the studio years ago and didn't really like what happened, but I loved the guitar solo that my buddy John Jennings did. Well, he died a couple of years ago, and I decided, well, let's re-record that completely around his guitar solo so that we could just pop it right in. And so it's really fun to be able to do a bluegrass thing and then do an entirely Latin thing. And I feel like one of the things I learned from Pete is it's a big old world. There's lots of amazing things that you can learn, and as long as you're willing to experiment, and as wide ranging as this album is, I think Pete would have been surprised and excited by the kind of very ecumenical approach we took to the music.
You mentioned him getting censored on that Smothers Brothers show. Pete Seeger and his band, The Weavers, were also blacklisted for a long time.
And what a lot of people don't realize is The Weavers were huge. I mean, they had songs at the top of what was then called the Hit Parade for months. I mean, Irene Goodnight was seismic. And when they got blacklisted, or Pete especially, it was only Pete.
This is during the McCarthy era.
Yes, he testified before the House Un-American Activities Committee, and looking back at those testimonies, he did what nobody else did. He did not invoke the Fifth Amendment, but rather he addressed the committee directly. He said, "These are questions no American should be asked." And you look back on that now and say, that was the right answer. Mm-hmm. But when he couldn't get work, and they were enormous, I mean, forget, Peter, Paul, and Mary. I mean, the Weavers were a pop music phenomenon. He and his wife, Toshi, really, who was a remarkable woman, got on the phone and called all over the country to churches and labor groups and peace activists and folk singing, people that got together just to sing folk songs. And Pete went out and worked all those places, and the result of that is the folk music circuit that, I mean, Joe McCarthy created my job. He and Toshi Seeger. Now,
a fellow Wisconsinite.
Yeah. there's two names you never thought you'd hear in the same sentence, Joe McCarthy and Toshi Seeger.
How do you think those experiences in the 50s and 60s shaped the music that he wrote later on?
Well, some people say Pete was fearless. But being fearless, to me, connotes the fact that you don't appreciate the danger. Pete, rather, I think, was courageous, because when you're courageous, you know the consequences, you know the fears, and you face up to them and you conquer them. In his later years, I remember calling his house one time, and his wife Toshi answered the phone, and Toshi and I were good friends, and I said, "Hey, let me talk to Pete." She said, "Pete's on tour." I said, "What? He's 89. She says, "Yes, but he's worried about no longer being useful. And no matter what you do, whether you're a carpenter, a radio host, a musician, a mother, what you really hope in this world is that you can be useful."
We're speaking with and hearing music from folk singer John McCutcheon about his newly released 40th album. And when I say newly released, it's as of today. His Northern California tour also kicks off today. And you have a new song that you wrote very recently. Tell us about it and let's hear it.
Well, one thing that I do almost every year when I come here is I'm expected to have something fresh and topical. And I was playing up in the Gold Country last night, McComney Hill, and I got there early enough, and it was a beautiful day, and my room had a little balcony off of it, and I sat out in the sun and remembered a newspaper article I read about just recently about a little cafe in the South Texas borderline called the Borderline Cafe. And so words in McComney Hill, melody in the green room of insight. I stopped for gas just north of the river, a small Texas town that looked hard on its luck. They pointed me into the Borderline Cafe, said it's all that we got, and coffee's still just a buck. Una mesa por uno, she cried from the kitchen. Be out in a minute, says I, take your time. The menu, a chalkboard, hung near the window, and over the door was a sign. No hay muro entre amigos, between friends there is no wall. This river that flows here does not divide us. Instead, it is shared by us all. enchiladas with hush puppies, mole with cornbread, mariquitas with fried chicken breast. Here at these tables, we feast on our plenty, and each one contributes their best. No hay muro entre amigos, between friends there is no wall. This river that flows here does not divide us, instead it is shared by us all. Both sides of the river, we meet on the bridge on the 20th day each September. Por un abrazo en el puente, been that way long as I remember. In other places, far from the borderline, they gin up the hatred and fear with their talk about walls, terror and outlaws, but all our amigos down here. No hay muro entre amigos, between friends there is no wall. This river that flows here does not divide us, it is shared by us all. This river that flows here does not divide us, it is shared by us all.
Folk singer John McCutcheon with his just penned song for Insight, reflecting on the wall controversy on the U.S.-Mexico border. John, thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome, Randall. It's wonderful to be back here in Insight.
And good luck on the tour. People can find tour and album information online, of course, at capradio.org/insight. That is Insight for today. I'm Randall White. Insight produced by Bert Johnson and Cody Drabble. We got help today from Evan Massler, Jen Picard, and Matt Passini. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. Technical director is Mr. Mark Jones. Our managing editor is Linnea Edmeyer. Insight's executive producer, Joe Barr. We're back with you on Monday for another live show. Thank you, as always, for joining us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.